DW Deutsche Welle. Living Planet. From DW in Bonn, I'm Charlotte Lomas. Coming up on the show, post-Katrina, how New Orleans became a beacon for the world.
Katrina definitely caused a break in the status quo. And so New Orleans has undertaken perhaps more reform simultaneously than any other modern American city, and it is certainly due to Katrina.
Apps, not arms, why Indigenous tribes are using smartphones in the fight against deforestation.
The frontier of soy farms and things like that are encroaching on the Indigenous territory more and more every day. And having these maps showing, you know, where they're using the land, and also having the capability to monitor deforestation is going to allow them to protect the boundaries of their territory even better.
Plus, could laser guns help Norway rid itself of a threatening parasite? Stay tuned to find out. Louisiana battles to cope with the catastrophic effects of flooding. For some residents, the ordeal was all too familiar. 11 years ago, Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast of the United States. And by many accounts, it was the costliest natural disaster in U.S. history, wreaking destruction across the states of Louisiana, Alabama, and Mississippi. More than 1,000 people died, and hundreds of thousands were displaced. The city of New Orleans in Louisiana was hit especially hard. Around 80% of the city was flooded, and the water took weeks to recede. The aftermath of Katrina was a picture of dysfunction and disaster. Now, more than a decade on, New Orleans has picked itself up, dusted itself off, and become a symbol of resilience in the face of climate change. From there, Heidi Fuller Love has more.
A brass band marches along Bourbon Street in New Orleans' historic French Quarter, one of the areas where victims took refuge after levee failures during Hurricane Katrina in 2005 caused dramatic floods. These streets where, just over a decade ago, bewildered homeless, carrying what was left of their lives on their backs, camped on improvised bedding, are now filled with tourists. And thanks to innovative projects, musicians are once again playing in the bars of the city known as the Big Easy. But 1,000 deaths and 600,000 displaced households aren't forgotten in a decade.
The rotting vegetation. The smell was terrible. Then the quiet. There was not a bird to be heard. And so the city was silent. And at night, with no street lights and no traffic lights and no business lights, the city was like being in the middle of a forest on a dark night. It was like that for months. I mean, think about that. Have you ever been in a city where there was not one light?
Linger a while to chat with locals, and you'll find that everyone has their Katrina story, including local tour guide Dominic Musso, who was born here in New Orleans and helped rebuild the city after the floods.
You know, most people don't have a full appreciation of the fact that water is as destructive as it is, and it lingered here as long as it did. It didn't come through, it stayed. So the city was pretty much underwater for weeks. And I call it marinating. Everything marinated in what was being called at that time toxic soup. Because not only did the city go underwater, but the surrounding swamps rose, and the alligators and the snakes and the raccoons and deer and the bear came into the city. Yes. And of the 900 or so people who were never found, we do believe that some of them succumbed to animals, wild animals. And so you might go into your kitchen and find an alligator on the counter.
I was evacuated, just like 80% of the city, and watching my house and my city drown.
Allison Plyer is executive director and chief demographer of the New Orleans-based Data Center, a think tank focusing on southern Louisiana.
After a disaster, there's a lot of uncertainty, a tremendous number of rumors start circulating, people start operating completely on anecdote. There's just, whatever you assume to be true is wiped away. There's just absolute lack of data, and so we'll start to put forward data so that they at least understand what the situation is, and then we can start looking at trends so that they can start to see which direction things are heading and decide whether that's optimal or not and whether they want to make changes, and we can start to say, you know, where those changes might lead.
After 5 years collating vital data, Allison and her colleagues at the data center noticed a significant shift in perception. They slowly became aware that the struggle to survive had transformed into a desire to adapt and thrive.
The natural inclination is to track, where you are relative to where you were when the disaster struck, right? So how many people live in the city relative to July 2005? How many jobs do we have? How's the economy doing? How's the housing market, et cetera? So we did that kind of recovery measurement for about 5 years. And then at the fifth anniversary of Katrina, we shifted because we realized we didn't necessarily want everything to be back exactly the way it was in July 2005 because our economy wasn't very strong in July of 2005 and we had a lot of problems in July of 2005. So instead we looked more aspirationally at where we wanted to go from there and started looking at our progress toward prosperity and measuring that.
Some observers claim, however, that the effect of the hurricane was much greater on black and less economically advanced people who have had more difficulty bouncing back.
That's what happens when disasters happen, is that existing trends get accelerated. So suburbanization of poverty, inequality in New Orleans itself and in the metro area is a big problem. It's a big problem nationwide. It's getting worse nationwide. And it's particularly bad in New Orleans. And I think we have the second worst income inequality in the country after Atlanta.
One of the groups that were badly hit by the hurricane were the city's musicians.
We started talking to Harry Gibson, we should build a school. I said, an education center would be great. And then Harry said, yeah, you know, man, they have this thing with Habitat for Humanity. You know, maybe we could build some homes for musicians. I said, man, that's...
The Ellis Marsalis Center for Music in the Ninth Ward, where music legends, including Fats Domino, lived before Katrina, is one of the projects that was created to address the problem. Devised by saxophonist Branford Marsalis and singer-actor Harry Connick Jr., the centre, which provides a home for musicians and a positive environment where underserved youth can develop both musically and academically, has been hailed as the project that has kept music alive in New Orleans.
The ability to be resilient in the face of any shock requires that a region has a diverse economy, high shares of skilled workers, low poverty rates, also trust in government, community problem-solving capacity, and attachment to place. All of those are really important aspects of ensuring that a region can be resilient in the face of any shock. So we started looking at all of those aspects of New Orleans because we know that New Orleans, just like every city around the globe, is going to face shocks in the future, and we need to see what kind of capacity we have to be able to deal with those.
New Orleans might not score top marks on all counts, but indicators such as the Metro New Orleans entrepreneurship rate, which is 64% higher than the national average, along with a surge of investments in youth projects, reductions in crime, and radical improvement in the city's education system, seem to point to the hope of a better future for the city that nearly drowned.
Well, Hurricane Katrina definitely caused a break in the status quo. And so things that we thought that we could never effectively address have been tackled. We've got housing reforms going on. We've got much more robust economic development work underway. We've got criminal justice reforms underway. Yes, New Orleans has undertaken perhaps more reforms simultaneously than any other modern American city, and it is certainly due to Katrina.
Vitally, too, the city has become a testing ground for innovative projects, including the Lake Boyne Protection Barrier, nicknamed by locals the Great Wall of Louisiana.
After the storm, the Army Corps of Engineers said, you know, if we simply build a wall here, this can never happen again. In fact, they took a 17-year project and completed it in 3 years. The pilings under this wall are over 200 feet in the ground. It's almost 300 feet from top to bottom.
The state's problem of erosion, which has already resulted in the disappearance of some 2,000 square miles of Louisiana's 7,000-year-old wetlands ecosystem, is also finally being addressed.
What we're doing now is we're building gates in the river to open them periodically and mimic floods in a controlled way. So we are now building pressure relief valves so that we can, in a controlled way, let sediment out, plant it, and build land. And by doing that, we're creating fisheries again, and we're also creating a defensive barrier to the storm. It won't stop a storm, but it will slow the storm down.
In his recent speech, Mayor Landrieu declared that the city of New Orleans has become a shining example to all America of what is possible.
But I really personally believe that in a post-Katrina world, the right people showed up. And I think that the city is going to be better in the future than it's ever been. In fact, I'm a little sad that I'm as old as I am because I may not get to see all the real changes that are clearly happening.
More than a decade after Hurricane Katrina, with many countries facing their own climate issues, Americans' beacon of resilience seems set to become a leading light for the world. Heidi Fullerlove, DW, New Orleans.
Just urban areas like New Orleans that are having to adapt to environmental challenges. Some of the world's most remote communities are too. In Brazil's Amazon basin, agricultural plantations, cattle ranching and logging are driving deforestation. And despite satellite imaging technology, small-scale illegal logging can be difficult to monitor, which is why one indigenous tribe is looking to GPS mapping on smartphones in order to protect their forests. In Costa Rica, our reporter James Perler went along for a test drive of the apps.
It's a sun-spotted day at OSA Conservation's Piro Research Center, and I'm holding a Ziploc bag filled with 5 Motorola smartphones. Because of the humidity here in Costa Rica's Piro rainforest, it's important to keep things dry. Brian Hetler, a mapping specialist from the Amazon conservation team, explains the apps he's programmed onto these smartphones.
Yeah, so what we'll be using today is our two applications. First, Open Data Kit, actually a version of it called GeoODK, which has a bit more robust mapping capabilities. It actually has a map interface so you can review the data on a base map. We'll also be showing them Forest Watcher from Jane Goodall Institute, Global Forest Watch, and Google Earth Outreach, which is a tool that is used in along with GeoODK that allows people to download deforestation data, deforestation alerts, and then go to those places and record what's happening there.
We're about to start a demonstration on how to use these maps to monitor deforestation and biodiversity in the rainforest. We're with members of the Wau-Ra, a tribe of about 300 people who live in the Xingu region of central Brazil. They've come here to learn how to use the apps.
I was there about a year and a half ago, and we showed them some satellite images of the territory and how the deforestation is closing in. And in the case of the Xingu, there's the frontier of soy farms and things like that are encroaching on the indigenous territory more and more every day. And having these maps showing, you know, where they're using the land and also having the capability to monitor deforestation is going to allow them to protect the boundaries of their territory even better.
Using smartphones, the Wau-Ra can take pictures and collect data to advocate for more on-the-ground law enforcement in Brazil. Santiago Palacios, another mapping specialist from the Amazon Conservation Team's Colombia office, says this mobile technology allows indigenous groups to map and monitor for themselves all kinds of environmental concerns.
Cuando você está falando das mudanças climáticas.
It's important also because when you're talking about climate change, you have to do this with the communities. You can't do it in an office away from the indigenous people. It's important that the population can go out and get the data. And the people who live in Xingu are the people who know this information.
Using the Open Data Kit, people like Yaukuma, a short, stocky wrestler from the Wau-Ra tribe, can document environmental data and the stories associated with culturally significant sites. Yaukuma says, for this reason, he's excited to use this technology.
Eu quero tirar a foto dos animais, das fauna.
I want to take pictures of the animals, the fauna. What's also important for us is the traditional medicine and the stories too.
O remédio tradicional, essas histórias também.
Mapping specialist Santiago says this approach is ideal because you can use functionalities like voice recording to document the Wau-Ra stories at specific points on the map.
The idea is that you don't have to write things down. When you go back home, you can record, say, the history of that tree over there on the phone.
Yeah, you don't need a pen or paper.
Equipped with our devices, we head out into Costa Rica's lush Rio Piro rainforest. Only a few steps into the forest, we hear a group of howler monkeys in the canopy. Our mapping expert Brian Hettler explains the Open Data Kit in action.
So what they're doing now is using the application to record that there's a monkey here, record the location of it, and take a photo of it. Open Data Kit allows the user to streamline data collection to make it easier, but it also results in better data because you can create a structured form so that everybody that's collecting information will collect similar type of information.
Brazil contains 40 threatened monkey species, more than any other country in the world. And the Wau-Ra want to collect information on monkeys to maintain the balance of species in the forest. Here's Hettler again.
So the Wau-Ra don't eat any kind of animals except for monkeys because kind of an old oral history about where the monkeys came from and that the other animals are relatives, so they don't eat them. So they're interested in monitoring the population of the monkeys so that there's always going to be monkeys there to eat in the future, which they eat only at special occasions. So using these tools, they'll be able to monitor where the monkeys are, their population levels, and use that information to help manage the consumption of monkeys.
So after taking a picture of this monkey in the forest, the data will automatically upload onto the cloud when we return to any Wi-Fi connected area. For the Waura, they will be able to upload data at the Ulupuene village, which recently got connected to the internet in 2015.
After the original collaborative cultural maps with the Xinguanos, they identified this one spot called Ulupuene, where the spirit of the grandmother lived. So this is an area right at the southwest corner of the Xingu indigenous territory. And by establishing this village there on the Batovi River, they're able to protect that corner of the reserve.
Yakuma says he's eager to use these GPS maps back home in Brazil.
I like it a lot. I'll use it a lot, you know? I'll use it to collect information about everything I can.
And while they're just beginning to use this mobile mapping technology to document their territory and cultural heritage, indigenous communities like the Waura are helping to protect critical areas in the vast Amazon for us all. I'm James Perla for DW, Rio Piro, Costa Rica.
Staying with technology, we turn to lasers. While laser technology has been around for years, new applications for the use of laser are being found all the time. Now, a small team of Norwegian inventors have taken lasers to new heights, or rather, new depths. They have built underwater laser guns to target a small parasite that's threatening the country's vast fish farming industry. In Oslo, Lars Bevanga went to find out more.
At one of Norway's more than 1,200 fish farms, it's feeding time for the salmon. The fish pens are showered with nutritious pellets, and the sea soon starts boiling with hungry fish snapping them up. Norway's aquaculture industry is massive. 60% of the world's Atlantic salmon is produced here. The annual export is worth more than 5 billion euro. But as the industry has grown, so have the numbers of a small parasite, which has become its biggest threat, the sea lice. It damages the fish, which then cannot be used as food. All this comes at a cost of some 310 million euro a year. And the parasite has begun developing resistance to medicines, which are now routinely added to the fish feed.
This is then the test bench, and now we are in the laboratory that we can take all the lasers when they are coming in, and we can do a final check to see that everything is okay.
Jon Arne Breivik and his company, Stingray, believe they've found a possible non-invasive solution to the sea lice challenge. They're operating out of an industrial estate in Oslo, hundreds of kilometres away from Norway's West Coast fish farms.
And what you can see here is then that we are using a green laser. And the reason for that was simply because we found that it was the best color to be absorbed by the sea lice.
They've constructed a unit the size of a punching bag containing cameras, sensors and, crucially, a laser gun, which can all be submerged into the pens of fish farms. What happens next might sound like science fiction, but it's very much science fact.
As the fish swim by, we detect the sea lice on the fish, and in a matter of some few milliseconds, the system decides that, okay, we will make a laser beam towards the sea lice, and we kill the sea lice as the fish is swimming by. So that means even that we have a lock on target like they have on the fighter planes, so it's a pretty cool thing.
Heavy fire, boss, 23 degrees, I see it, stay low.
And yes, watching the system in action is a bit like watching Star Wars. If you imagine the laser units as the Death Star and the salmon as spaceships. But wait, wouldn't that harm the fish?
The fish is like a disco ball or a mirror, if you like, and it reflects the light from the laser, whereas the sea lice itself absorbs the energy, and that's why it coagulates and dies.
So there's no harm done to the fish at all? Just bounces off?
Well, so far we have treated several millions of fish, and I can tell you that fish farmers have been there with their magnifying glass and the microscopes, and there haven't been one single damage or wound so far.
Environmental organisations have long sounded warning bells about the aquaculture industry in Norway and elsewhere. For them too, the main worry is the sea lice.
And now you have in a situation where we're producing 1.2 million tonnes of farmed salmon. And that means that there is such a huge amount of hostes for the parasite.
Karolina Andauer is a conservation director at WWF Norway. She says the scale of fish farming in Norway is what has brought the number of parasites out of control, and it impacts on wild salmon too.
Aquaculture in Norway, salmon farming, is doing in an open net system. It means that parasites can float freely between the wild environment and the cage that the farmed salmon is in.
So new technological solutions like laser treatment is, I guess, something that you would welcome?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of the technology that is interesting to see, but also it seems a little bit far-fetched that we can use only laser technology to shoot down every sea lice that is out there. We have to take one step back and see, well, what is really needed to actually solve the problem with sea lice, that it's a problem for the environment. And that is that the whole industry just has to sit down, come together, saying we can't grow anymore before we have a permanent solution on how to fix the sea lice problem.
The lice is rather big. It's the size of a fly. We are treating up to 1.5 meters away from the laser, and so the precision required is not that extreme.
Back at the Stingray Company's workshop, they remain optimists. This is Espen Beck, the engineer who had the initial idea for the sea lice laser gun. He's used to a certain level of skepticism, he says.
When you started presenting this idea to investors and people in the industry, what were their initial reactions?
I earned a lot of laughter because the initial thought of the majority of people I spoke to were that this could not be done. But I just was persistent and insisting on that it could be done. And so since the last 5 years, it has been all about sea lice every day.
So far, around 50 laser gun units are in operation at Norwegian fish farms, all controlled from the Oslo offices of Stingray. Orders keep coming in, though, and by the end of this year, they believe they'll have doubled the number of installations. While the laser treatment of salmon has proved efficient, the scale of the industry means that, for now, other treatments like chemicals and medicine will continue to play an important part in the fight against the sea lice. Lars Bevanger, DW, Oslo.
There is a house in New Orleans. They call the rising sun.
And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of Living Planet. Thanks to our studio team, Eliana Giaducci and Håkan Sider. And thank you for tuning in. If you'd like to listen to past episodes, just download the Living Planet podcast on iTunes or visit our website at dw.com/environment. I'm Charlotta Lomas. Catch you next week.